For everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we're raising the stakes and opening some books on betting. Debut author Martin Nathan discusses writing and playing poker with blind friends.
We did wonder about learning Braille so we could cheat, actually.
Biographer Anthony Holden delves into the history of poker and tells us how important it is in his life.
It was my annual birthday treat every May to go to Las Vegas with the guys I played with in London. We all had a wild old time.
Victoria Corran Mitchell shares her confessions of a poker player and what it's like to win millions.
Nice middle-class girl wandered into this strange underground community of cab drivers and criminals playing this old game from Westerns.
And racehorse owner Alan Pickering discusses a life spent with pensions and sight loss.
I mean, that was in the 60s, was it?
In the 50s.
In the 50s.
You've been kind to me now.
I can't see you.
That's all coming up in today's Read On. Martin Nathan's debut novel, A Place of Safety, is a tense psychological thriller set in London. The book's protagonist returns to the city after many years away, hoping that the sins of his youth lie buried in the past. But will they stay that way? Martin Nathan came into our Camden studio to tell me more about the book and his close links to sight loss. Martin Nathan, welcome to Read On.
Thank you.
Could you set the scene for A Place of Safety?
Okay. The starting point for the book was I was working as part of a community supermarket, and we used to have these great long meetings. And at the end of one of these meetings, someone began to talk about some courses he was running in well-being. And there was just something about the way he delivered his message that was kind of compelling. And I began to think about that power to command an audience and using that power either malevolently or benevolently. And so that was the starting point. I thought of someone who's kind of returned after being away from an area, and he's kind of rebuilt his life, and he has that power to command an audience, but he uses it malevolently. He's on a course of trying to uncover the core of his identity and why he committed an act of violence in his childhood, which has led him to leave the area that he lived in. The story is set around Brixton and Tulse Hill, which is an area I've lived in for many years, and it's told through four narrators, none of which is actually Andrew, the main character. So we're seeing him from four different characters, and we get slightly different views of him and of events, none of which quite reconcile at the end. So I think it's kind of like the way life works, that you're never quite sure what has happened, and things never quite tie up in the way maybe we would like them to.
Andrew's a compelling and charismatic character who draws people along with him, and yet, as the fact that he has rebuilt his life after this shocking act of violence in his childhood proves, but that act of violence can never be erased fully. He might have rebuilt his life, but the consequences are still the same for everybody else. It's an interesting study in how one person can move on, but a community might not.
Yeah, we can't ever erase the past in the way we might like to. But another element of the story is each of the narrators is at a point in their life when they are trying to move on, where they have a kind of particular dream that they want to fulfil. And when he arrives, he seems as though he is going to fulfil that dream. And he does briefly, but in the way of fiction, it never goes the way that they would like.
Do you think that's reflects something in people, that they are looking for a leader? They are looking for somebody to lead them out onto the next part of their journey, that it's an innate characteristic in people?
I think a leader, possibly as a person, or it may be something else, it may be a technological answer. I think a lot of people's lives are driven by the idea that there is a fairly simple answer to what is stopping their lives being what they might dream of them becoming.
Are you a man who has had a yen to write a novel? It sounds to me as if it was almost an epiphany moment for you when you were working at this community supermarket. Oh, I do have a story inside me.
I have. I've always been interested in fiction, and from quite an early age, I was writing fiction. I had some quite promising events when I was in my early 20s, which then didn't really quite happen, and so I got quite disillusioned for a long time. So it was only really later on that I suddenly thought, actually, you just need to get on with it. And so I did.
And as you say, London is very much a character in the book, as well as the five main characters of the book. You seem to have a very strong sense of place.
Yeah, I think part of being a writer is actually seeing a place from the outside and noticing those little details, which you kind of get inured to after a while, but you have to kind of step back and actually look at what is strange about their behaviour and the logic that drives them. And certainly around Brixton and Tulse Hill, there was a lot of interesting behaviour.
Yeah, a lot of diversity, and also a lot of diversity in terms of disability as well. And I believe sight loss has been a factor in your life since really quite early on.
Yes, my brother lost his sight in his early 20s. It was the result of a mitochondrial disease, and it kind of happened in bursts and got worse and worse. But he's had to stop work recently. He did manage to work. He was kind of chose accountancy, which was maybe not the ideal subject, but he managed with kind of various visual aids. He had to change the area that he was working in, but he managed to work until quite recently. By kind of strange irony, I originally went to medical college, and I used to get frustrated by the fact that a lot of the stuff we studied were these mitochondrial diseases, which were kind of really rare. You know, it's like one in a million, one in 5 million. And yeah, I kind of thought actually we should be focusing on more common diseases. And then by the strange irony, I find that my brother and myself, because of the nature of mitochondrial diseases, do have this one of these diseases. But I've not been affected by it yet. And also a very good friend of mine, he has total sight loss, and we play poker together using braille cards, and we have an intermittent book club as well. It's been quite interesting actually, because you really notice the difference between the way he absorbs a book from audiobooks, from the amount, because he remembers things in such clarity and such detail in a way that the rest of us don't when we kind of read books. We obviously skim much more than we realise.
And with the braille poker cards, have they still got the pictures printed on them as well, or have you had to learn braille to be able to play with your friend?
No, we did wonder about learning braille so we could cheat, actually. But, no, we do have the printed card. They do have the images as well.
Fantastic, although I suppose he can't get the benefit of your poker face whilst you're...
I think that might be an advantage, actually. He does a... Yeah, they don't seem to do braille chips, which is surprising, but he seems to manage quite well anyway.
Well, there's an idea for the R&IB shop. And I believe your work has also taken you into helping with accessibility for visually impaired people as well.
Yes, until recently, I worked as a design engineer for the Underground, and I was involved in a number of projects with the RNIB. We worked on a accessibility guidance system, which kind of broadcast geographic information to help people get down to the platform level unassisted. And we also did a audio broadcast of train arrival information. So we had one at Angel for a long time, and we did one at Great Portland Street, but now we've done it just as a general thing as a result of the disability regulation. So now basically all of the train arrivals are announced, so it's not, whereas before it was a broadcast on a special frequency and you had to have the right headset, now it's much easier and much better.
It's terrific not having to count stops on the tube or ask people on the platform when the next tube is coming, and whether it's a High Barnet train or not, it's the more information we can get on the tube, the better.
Yeah, especially on the Northern Line.
Absolutely, yes. So you don't want to get on the wrong branch. You've now stopped working as an engineer. Does this mean that you're writing full time?
Yes. I'm just in the last week, actually. I left and I'm concentrating on a few new projects.
And there's a second book in the pipeline?
Yes. I've got a book which is based around some family history, which is all told through letters, which has been quite interesting. It kind of came out of the blue, really. I was working on another book, and then suddenly this book appeared as a result of this workshop I attended. Yeah, it's based on some of my family who were out in Malaya, and their daughter stopped getting letters back from them, didn't know the reason why for a long time, and then they found that their aunt and uncle had kept the reason secret from them, and I think it affected them all quite badly in their lives. So it's following that bit of history.
Martin Nathan, thank you very much for coming into the Read On studios and being a guest on the show.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure.
A Place of Safety is out now in print and ebook wherever you buy your books. You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in today's show, we've got plenty more on blind poker players, and a blind horse racing enthusiast gives us his tip for a top read. But first, Anthony Holden is a writer and biographer who balances his serious literary pursuits with a passion for poker. Read On's own poker enthusiast, Robert Kirkwood, met up with him at the Edinburgh International Book Festival.
Thanks, Red. I spoke to Anthony Holden just before he was due to go on stage for a talk, and I first of all asked him what we could expect.
Well, I'm not sure, because I've written several books on poker. The most recent one is a manual called Holden on Hold'em, which is designed for both beginners but also for people who know how to play to maybe improve their game a bit. But probably it's more entertaining for an audience here at the book festival and on the radio to talk about my previous books called Big Deal and Bigger Deal, where I go out into the big wide world and try my hand.
This book is the story of a year spent by biographer Anthony Holden in the tough world of the professional poker player. He spent days and nights in the poker paradise of Las Vegas, in Malta and Morocco, even on board a ship, mingling with the legendary greats, sharpening his game, perfecting his repartee, and learning a great deal about himself in the process. Poker, Holden insists, is not gambling. Like chess, it is a paradigm of life at its most intense, a gladiatorial contest that brings out the best as well as the worst in people.
Now, what I've noticed about particularly Big Deal, it's rich in the history of poker. Is that something that really interests you?
I think when I got into I got into it like so many people as a student and in one's misspent youth. But when I started writing that book, I was just around 40 and travelling around the United States. So, yes, I did look in at the U.S. Playing Card Museum in Cincinnati, Ohio, because I was interested in why kings were kings and why queens were queens and who they represented, and all that's in that book.
The particular card which had drawn me here possesses its own unique dimension of menace. Throughout the Far East, the Ace of Spades is known as the card of death. In 1966, this plant produced several million for use as a secret weapon by American troops in Vietnam. At the request of the U.S. government, acting on the suggestion of two lieutenants of C Company, 2nd Battalion, 35th Regiment, 25th Infantry Division, whole decks of aces of spades packed in plain white boxes were flown out to the front, where they are said to have spread terror among the Viet Cong.
But also poker's a comparatively young game. It began in the 1820s in the southern United States, imported by French sailors, and what interested me was it progressed west across the United States, as did humanity. So it was a kind of frontier game, and I got caught up in all the romance of the riverboat gamblers and Wild Bill Hickok being shot in the back of the head while holding aces and eights, thereafter ever known as Dead Man's Hand, and so on. And yeah, it somehow it hooks up with poker was then, but that was 20 years ago before the boom which has overtaken us all these last few years.
The game of poker had been born in New Orleans in the early 1820s, when French sailors imported their own version of a game called As, which they had picked up in Persia. A direct descendant of the ancient Persian game As-Nas, which dates back to the 14th century, the French game of poke, P-O-Q-U-E, was played with a pack of 20 cards, four aces, kings, queens, jacks and tens. Five cards each were dealt to four players. The notion of drawing fresh cards had yet to be conceived. Straights and flushes would not be introduced for another 50 years. The players would simply bet their hands until they reached a showdown. The element of bluff, therefore, was evidently the game's primary skill and attraction.
Now, the boom you mentioned is mainly due to internet and televised poker. Has it changed beyond all recognition, and do you miss the old poker?
I do. My mind goes back to the old days when it was much more of a community thing with camaraderie, and although we were all trying to take each other's money and beat each other in tournaments, we were all pals. It was my annual birthday treat every May to go to Las Vegas with the guys I played with in London. We all had a wild old time away from wives and families for a week or two. These days, if you've been recently, I've just got back from a month in Las Vegas. There's 9,000 people participating in the World Series of Poker. The prize money is massively life-altering. It's bigger than any other sport. But there's something cold about it and something clinical. And because of television, you get a lot more misbehavior now. You get if people win a hand, beat somebody unluckily, they leap on the table, they jump about because they've seen people do this on television. This is not what they should be doing. It's not good etiquette.
But poker isn't the only thing you write about. You're also a biographer.
Yes, I've got a ridiculous range of interests and enthusiasms and a journalist training. So I've really just written books about things that have interested me, from literature. I love Shakespeare, so I wrote A Life of Shakespeare. Music, I love music, so I wrote A Life of Tchaikovsky. The theatre, I love theatre, so I wrote A Life of Laurence Olivier. For a while, I was interested in the royals, and I wrote a couple of biographies of Prince Charles, which changed and got increasingly hostile because I went off the whole idea of monarchy to the extent where I gave that up, and that was now called that a previous self that did that. But poker's been a kind of constant throughout, and the reason the first book, Big Deal, happened was that I played in this London game where two players had already written books about poker. Al Alvarez, who's a very old friend of mine, had written a great book called The Biggest Game in Town. David Spanier, now alas deceased, had written a book called Total Poker. So it seemed to be obligatory, really, to write a book about it. We were all writers or journos or media people. And these days in Vegas, when I meet strangers who say they've read Big Deal and they're very nice about it, they say, how the hell did those three classic books all come from one little home game in London? It's just the way it turned out.
Whether he likes it or not, a man's character is stripped bare at the poker table. If the other players read him better than he does, he has only himself to blame. Unless he is both able and prepared to see himself as others do, flaws and all, he will be a loser in cards as in life. These mysteries are one reason why the game of poker has always appealed so strongly to literary and artistic types, who see in it many makeshift metaphors for the human condition.
I've tried to explore if there is a link between poker and writing, which there's said to be, going back to Damon Runyon and the Algonquin Round Table and all that. And in fact, when Big Deal came out, a magazine put up a writer's game to test this thesis. I played with Alvarez, Martin Amis, David Mamet, playwright Patrick Marber, who I play with anyway on Friday nights in London. And we were all just so concerned to beat each other and write the most vivid account of this game that I've decided in the end I don't think there is. I think writers just play poker to avoid writing, because most writers don't like writing. They have to do it, they've got this elemental need, but they don't actually enjoy it. They enjoy the acclaim when it's over, but actually doing it is hell. I think most of my writer friends say that. So they'd rather play cards. Otherwise, I can't find any link at all, no.
I've heard that a few players do listen to audiobooks, particularly poker manuals, when they're playing. Is that something you've ever done?
I've listened to music when I'm playing, because one thing you do need is patience, waiting for the right. That's another deceptive thing about television. Every hand on television is interesting because they miss out the half-hour boring bits in between where you're waiting for the next interesting thing to happen. I don't think I could listen to words and play poker at the same time. There are players who make themselves tapes telling them how wonderful they are, how patient they are, how they're going to win this thing, how determined they are, how clever they are, and they play those in their own ears to keep their morale up. And I can believe it that people listen to manuals. Now the RNIB's made a tape of Big Deal. Maybe people will listen to Big Deal while playing poker, and I hope I'm at the table when they do.
Now, you once described when a writer got to the final table, it was like sending a poet to the moon. Do you think you're ever going to get a chance to go to the moon?
Well, I keep trying. The guy in question, I didn't know him when that happened, but he's become a good friend of mine now, called James McManus. He wrote a marvellous account of it, a book called Positively Fifth Street. And this autumn he has coming out, if you think Big Deal taught you about the history of poker, he has a huge, earnest, academic history of poker coming out, mostly to the United States, but of course, the last few years it covers the rest of the world as well. I keep trying. I played every year with a brief gap for 20 years now, but no, I've never done it. And the great Doyle Brunson, one of the world's most famous poker players, says he thinks nobody over 50 will ever win it again because of the stamina involved. To win it now, with this many starters, you literally have to play 14-hour days every day for a fortnight, and that is exhausting. It's not quite like running a marathon every day, but it's running an intellectual marathon every day.
Now, blind poker players are missing one vital element whereby they can't see the other players. Do you think that matters an awful lot?
I've seen a blind poker player playing in the World Series, and I believe it's called a whisperer. Reads the cards for him or her. Remarkable in itself. Yes, it is a disadvantage not to be able to see the whites of the eyes of the other players. I don't know whether a blind person can smell weakness, which a good player is said to be able to do. But of course, if you think about it, on the internet, where most people play, and there are millions these days, you can't see the opponents. You're going only on the cards. And you do get a sense of the opponent's betting patterns. That's what it's about in certain positions. Whether they're aggressive or all these phrases like loose, tight, passive-aggressive, etc. And I think a non-sighted player would pick that up as the game grinds on. So I'm sure a blind player can do extremely well, and it's not that much of a disadvantage.
And finally, sighted or blind poker players, what's your one big tip?
My one big tip is be patient, be confident, be ruthless, and above all, don't drink at the table. That's a mistake many people make. You're not allowed to smoke anymore, much to my displeasure. But I think just hang in there and hope. And if you play, most of the people who win tournaments play tournaments every day. I think you have to play often, get the experience, and one of these days you will win. That's what I keep telling myself anyway.
Anthony Holden, thank you very much for joining me.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Holden's books, Big Deal, Bigger Deal, and Holden on Hold'em, are available wherever books are sold. And Big Deal is also available in audio from RNIB. Here's a clip that Anthony says sums up Las Vegas.
Early one May morning in the mid-1980s, patrons of the coffee shop of the Golden Nugget Hotel and Casino, Las Vegas, were confronted by the unusual sight of a lone figure at the breakfast bar reading a black-backed Penguin Classic over his oatmeal and waffles. "What's that you're reading?" "Oh, just a book about gambling." "Yeah? What's it called?" "My name's Harry, by the way." "Tony." We leant over and shook hands. "It's called The Gambler." I showed him the jacket, hoping that it would de-wimp me in my companion's eyes, and playing a hunch that the author's name would mean nothing to him. "The Gambler? Don't know that one. New manual, huh? Who's it by?" "No, it's not really a manual, Harry. It's a novel. Well, a short story. By a guy called Dostoevsky." There was no flicker of recognition. "A Russian," I added helpfully. "A roulette freak. He's dead now."
"A red, huh? A dead red?"
He laughed, and so did I.
"Any good?"
I was still working out how to answer that one, when a third party came to my rescue. Another solitary caffeine addict sitting opposite. He had evidently been following these exchanges with interest and awaiting his cue to join in.
"Dostoevsky, did you say Dostoevsky? You're reading Dostoevsky in Las Vegas?"
I mumbled my assent, and Harry leant towards the interloper, sensing that there was something here he was missing out on, maybe some secret new number system we would share with him.
"What's so strange about that?" he asked him. Well, Dostoevsky, he's big stuff. That's real literature. Not the kind of thing you see people reading here in Vegas. This, to all of us, seemed a truth too solemn to bear further discussion. We sat in silence for a moment before the new arrival continued his train of thought, addressing himself directly at me with the utmost gravity. "You know," he said, "I'd be prepared to bet that you just might be the only person in the history of Las Vegas to have read Dostoevsky in Las Vegas." "That's so?" said Harry, his eyes brightening. "What else do you want on that?"
Steve Hodson reading from Big Deal by Anthony Holden, which is Talking Book 12991. Anthony's biographies of Prince Charles, Olivier and Tchaikovsky are also available from RNIB Talking Books. For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. And I'll be continuing this discussion about blind poker players with Victoria Corin-Mitchell after this.
RNIB. Supporting people with sight loss.
Would you like to chat over the telephone with a group of like-minded people? RNIB's award-winning telephone social groups are small, friendly and lots of fun. A great way of making new friends and a chance to socialise without leaving the comfort of your home. Telephone RNIB Talk and Support on 0845 330 3723 or email talkandsupport@rnib.org.uk.
You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Alan Pickering on sight loss and pensions. But before that, Victoria Corin-Mitchell is a writer, presenter and professional poker player. She's the only person to have won two European Poker Tour main events. And her total winnings to date amount to nearly £2 million. So Robert Kirkwood was keen to discover more.
You wrote for Richer for Poorer after you won your first EPT main event, and then a few months later it came out in paperback, but the name had slightly changed. Why was that?
It has changed. In hardback, the title was A Love Affair with Poker, which I liked, but for the new version, it's Confessions of a Player, and the reason my publishers were worried that people were mistaking it for a technical guide. When it first came out, it was stocked in the indoor game section in most bookshops, still is actually, and I think they wanted to convey, no, look, this is a life story, it's not a how to play book. And also, let's be honest, Confessions of a Player, it sounds like it's going to be a bit sexy. It isn't, but I think they were hoping to trick some people into buying it for the source.
That's remarkably open and emotional. Was that the plan from the start?
I think so. I mean, this is ultimately an autobiography. It's not everything in my life, but it's like Fever Pitch. Nick Hornby talks about his relationship with football, and it's a way of doing an autobiography. And I always felt there is no point writing a book about poker unless I'm going to be honest about it. You know, poker's had this big revolution, everybody writes about it, but what you get is kind of PR-driven autobiographies from these big stars who won't tell you anything bad ever happened. It's all about being in jacuzzis with models and winning big tournaments. And I thought, you know what, if I'm going to write about it, I'm also going to write about loneliness and defeat and loss and really happy stuff as well, but I always meant it to be honest.
Now, you started your poker career before the boom, when it was still subterranean clubs and passwords at the door. I asked Anthony Holden this very same question, but do you miss those old days?
I really do miss those days. Obviously, what's happened in poker has made it much more lucrative. You know, it's much more respectable. You can travel all around the world and play pretty much anywhere, and there are far more people, and it has lots of pluses. But that's not what I got into it for. I was attracted to poker by the sort of seedy cowboy romance. I loved it that it was just a handful of people playing in basements that you needed passwords to get into. And I never really meant it to be a mass worldwide hobby. You know, swings and roundabouts.
Well, playing myself, and especially now working at RNIB, I've come across a number of blind poker players. And the debate always comes up about how important it is to actually see the other players.
Well, it depends on how you play. I've played with blind poker players and they can do perfectly. I mean, you need a special deck of cards, obviously, or actually once played with a guy who had somebody with him
who
whispered in his ear what the cards were, which, to be honest, I thought, well, I mean, he came here to gamble, because now, quite apart from the risks of playing poker, he's risking that someone is overhearing, or you play with a special deck. And, of course, there's no reason why you need to see the other players, because online poker is far bigger than live poker, and that you don't see the other players. So, you know, of course you can win either way. There's different sorts of poker. In the old-fashioned game, it's all about tells. It's all about noticing if this or that guy, you know, scratches his ear when he has a good hand. But it certainly, you can play in the modern internet style, which is just simply about the cards and the maths. And anyway, you know, blind players are still perfectly capable of sensing other people's nerves, confidence, if someone's bluffing, someone's not. Tells aren't all visual. A lot of them are in the speech patterns. You can sense if somebody is, you know, whether they're talking too much, talking too little. There's all sorts of ways of reading people. I mean, you might just as well say, how important is it when having a love affair to be able to see the other person? I mean, for goodness sake, you can get a sense of how a person feels and how they are. But actually, you know, a lot of people would call me an old, I don't know what the word is, old trout, I was going to say, old school type of person, because an 18-year-old would say it's not about people's skills at all, and they don't care who feels nervous, who's blustering, who's bluffing. They're purely playing a mathematical game. Your average modern 19-year-old Swedish player would say that was all irrelevant.
The Whisperer has been endorsed by the World Series of Poker, and that's the official way that blind poker players can learn what cards are in front of them. I think the argument being that if a special deck was used, if a blind player moved tables, all the cards at that table would then be changed. So,
You could argue, why doesn't everybody play with a special deck of cards? What difference? Although it did work, you know, there's a guy plays quite often in one of the card rooms I play at in Vegas. He always has somebody there whispering the cards, and as far as I know, that's never got him into any trouble. Nobody's ever been able to cheat that way. I mean, I'd worry about what if there was somebody on the other side of the table with a lip reader. You know, poker players are terrible people. Give them any kind of edge, they'll find a way to exploit it. But as far as I know, that guy that I've played with that has the Whisperer with him, it's never been any kind of obstacle. Hasn't been cheated that way yet.
Now, the book can be read as a straight memoir, even if you know nothing about poker. In fact, it may get you interested in the game. It was producing the RNIB version of Anthony Holden's Big Deal that got me interested in playing. But the subchapters detailing that first EPT win are very detailed. Was that from memory, or were you having a sneaky look at some YouTube clips?
I didn't use YouTube. The way the book works is there's sort of A chapters and B chapters, and there's the main story, which is the life story. And then at the end of each chapter, there's a chapter from the big tournament, the European Championships, and it kind of talks the reader through that tournament, which is supposed to operate on two levels, really. For people that do play poker, it's, I hope, an interesting insight for them on how I approached the game, how I played the hands. They can argue they would have played it this way, that way themselves. And people who don't play, I'm hoping it just adds a sort of flavour. I mean, I mentioned Fever Pitch earlier. I am so uninterested in football, I can barely stay awake to get to the end of this sentence, and I certainly know nothing about it. But I love the book, and I love the language, and I love the references to things I didn't understand. And it's supposed to work like that, my book, for non-poker players. I did have a video that was broadcast at the time of that tournament, which I watched to refresh my memory, but it was really only about the exact bet sizes. You know, something like that. I remembered the situations. I remembered which of the key hands had been, what the other players had done. I checked the video for stuff like, you know, did I bet 150 or 135? That's just because, obviously, you know what people are like. If you say, I bet 120, someone will write in and say, no, I remember seeing it was 125. But really, I think most readers would say the important thing was, how did it feel? You know, I won $1 million in one night in this strange world that when I was a kid, nice middle-class girl, wandered into this strange underground community of cab drivers and criminals playing this old game from Westerns. And 15 years later, they were my friends. They were like family. And I got to win the European Championship. And I think more people would be interested in how that felt than how much I bet. And funnily enough, I remember that stuff.
Victoria Corrin Mitchell, thanks so much for being a guest on today's Read On.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Robert Kirkwood and to Victoria Corran Mitchell. A collection of her father's work, Chocolate and Cuckoo Clocks by Alan Corran, in which Victoria Corran Mitchell and her brother Giles read the introduction, is TB18569. It also features contributions from Victoria Wood, Melvin Bragg, and the book is narrated by Peter Noble.
I tried again, trembling slightly at his proximity. 500 million subjects under his thumb, and that thumb about to curl over the receiver in response to a far agnostic call.
Allo?
Your Holiness? Pause.
What?
Am I speaking to the Pope? Il Papa? Scuffling.
Allo? Allo? Can I help you?
May I speak to the Pope? A long, soft sigh. One of those very Italian sighs that express so much.
That say, ah, signor, if only this world were an ideal world, what would I not give to be able to do as you ask? We should sit together in the Tuscan sunshine, you and I, just two men together, and we should drink a bottle of the good red wine, and we should sing, ah, how we should sing, but God in his infinite wisdom has, alas, not seen fit to...
Can the Pope, I said, determined, come to the phone?
The Pope, he never come to the telephone, signor. Not for you, not for me, not for Italians, not for nobody.
Peter Noble reading Chocolate and Cuckoo Clocks by Alan Corran. TB18569. Alan Pickering has led a remarkable life. Despite losing his sight to retinitis pigmentosa, he became an acknowledged expert in pensions and led a government-commissioned report into them that bears his name. He's also made his mark in several sporting fields, including marathon running and horse racing. Now he's the subject of a new book, Look Where You're Going, the biography of Alan Pickering, CBE. It's out now, and Alan came into the studio to tell me more. Alan Pickering, welcome to Read On.
Thank you, Red.
You were 20 when you discovered that you had retinitis pigmentosa, I believe?
Yes, I was 20 when I found that my eyesight was beginning to decline. And I thought it was my fault that I wasn't trying hard enough. But I subsequently found out that it wasn't my fault. It was just the way that retinitis pigmentosa went. In some ways, it was the surprising thing was the way that the medical profession found that I had retinitis pigmentosa or an eye complaint, because when I was 3, I kept bumping into things, and my mother said there's something wrong with our Alan. So we went to the doctor, and the doctor said, oh no, he's just clumsy. And mother said, he isn't clumsy, he can't see very well, I don't think. So the doctor said, I know what I'll do. And he threw a paperclip on the floor and said, pick up that paperclip. And I said, what paperclip? And at long last, he believed my mother.
And things really... I mean, that was in the 60s, was it?
In the 50s.
In the 50s.
You've been kind to me now.
I can't see you. things really hadn't changed that much in the 70s and 80s. It's very strange to hear, you know, that my history was basically a fairly much a repeat of yours.
I mean, the next stage in my history really was having to go to a special school, and that has influenced me for the rest of my life, because once my mother found out that I couldn't see, in those days, open school wasn't really a prospect for me, so I got sent to a special school, and my particular special school was called an open-air school that was really for people who had had TB or polio, but there was one class for the partially sighted, and there were 16 of us in that class, and the youngest was 5 and the oldest was 16, and we had one teacher that looked after us all week, so the education prospects weren't that good. But what made it worse is that children can be quite cruel, and because I went to a different school to what the children in my street went to. They were cruel to me. I was different. I was strange. And in a way, I guess they found me repulsive. I guess people still find me repulsive. But in those days, children were quite cruel. And the teacher at the school said, no, Alan can achieve more than we can give him. And so the next crisis for my family came when I was told, or they were told, that the only prospect for getting a good education was to go to a boarding school. At that time, there was one school in Coventry that did O-level classes for partially sighted people. And my parents felt really guilty sending me off to school, but that education has really stood me in good stead for the rest of the life. But having been to special institutions the rest of my life, I wanted to be normal and didn't want to go anywhere near anything that was special or focused on people with my particular disability.
So what led you to become a specialist in the area of pensions and then eventually to producing the Pickering Report?
Accident, in a way. My first job on leaving school was on the railways in York, and my parents had always said, we don't care where you work so long as the job is pensionable. Little did they know that pensions would become my job. When I was working on the railway, they made it clear to me that career enhancement was a bit of a no-no because I had to sit the same eyesight test as an engine driver, and all I wanted to be was a clerk. But they said, no, you're not going to get any promotion. And again, I reacted against that. And so, having worked on the railway a couple of years, I went to Newcastle University as a mature student, then got a job at the head office of the Electrical and Plumbing Trade Union. And then on Derby Day 1974, a meeting cropped up with an employer to discuss pensions. There was nobody else in head office free that afternoon. I went to a pensions meeting. That meant I'd been to one more pensions meeting than anybody else at head office. And after that, pensions took off and became my career. And I now have a good pension as a result of being employed in pension. So quite symmetrical, really, Red.
Very much so. Well, I mean, your report, which was a government-commissioned report, was actually rather scathing about the last four decades of pensions policy. I think you called it a toxic mix of sclerosis and knee-jerk reaction. Could you explain exactly what you meant by that?
Yes. The problem with pensions is that it doesn't fit into the electoral cycle. Governments are elected for 5 years if they're lucky. And yet pensions, we need stability for 30 or 40 years so that people join a pension scheme and can look forward to benefiting from that pension in later life without people continually digging up the drains. Sadly, whenever there was a problem in the pension system, there's always problems in every system, the temptation of politicians was to respond to the somebody must do something about it. This is something and we're doing something about it, so aren't we good? But a lot of the changes that they made over the years were well-intentioned, but pension schemes were killed by kindness, really. Nobody took a step back and looked forward and thought, what can we map out for the next 20, 30 years? And what the government had done is they provided more and more legislative protection for people who were in pension schemes that made it very expensive for employers to provide pensions for people that weren't in pension schemes. So we got a bit of a fortress mentality. And I said to the government, let's back off some of this prescription. Let's put down the bridge so that more and more people can join our pension party. Governments, however, thought there are no votes in doing anything radical about pensions. So along with many other people in my ilk, I got kicked into the long grass.
I was struck. The book contains interviews with many senior politicians, a foreword by Alastair Darling, of course, a former Chancellor of the Exchequer, and senior people in pensions, investments, actuaries, all of whom give their judgments on your report's judgment. And I was struck by just how much of a canary in the mine your report was in many ways, that it did point out to many people that exactly that, that governments are in just for the 5-year term and hopefully to get re-elected. And just like the NHS and education, pensions are a long game that need decades of investment. Do you think that possibly all party parliamentary groups should consider big national issues like this rather than it being allowed to be dictated by single parties who just want to get re-elected?
Yeah, I think that in theory, all party groups are a good idea, but even those all-party groups have now become more interested in grabbing headlines than laying down the foundations for coherent, long-term, acceptable policies. We just have to see how certain parliamentary committees have got British Home Stores and Sir Philip Green in their sights. It's been really entertaining television, but I'm not sure that it's good politics. They want to get on the 9 o'clock news at night. Their main aim is to get the headlines rather than to have a legacy in 30 years saying that because of their thoughtful promulgations, the world is a lot better than it would have been without it. They just want to be on the 9 o'clock news, sadly, Red.
Well, I mean, your biography is a very thoughtful book. I must say I picked it up thinking, oh, pensions, what do I know and what do I not really want to know? And it's far broader in its sweep than that. You're clearly a man who is happy to deal with weighty issues, but you also have a great sense of fun and you've given a lot of time and commitment to sporting endeavours over the years, haven't you?
Yes, I mean, Paddy Briggs, who wrote the book for me, we've tried to compartmentalise the book because my life was compartmentalised in a way, because it comes through in the book that people who know me in pensions don't know me in sport and people who know me in sport don't know me in pensions. So we thought if it's just about pensions, it'd be the biggest turn-off you could ever have. So there are chapters on living with a disability, but lots of chapters on sport. I've been a sports fanatic growing up in York. I was a York City supporter, York Rugby League supporter, Yorkshire County Cricket Club follower, and horse racing. So I've always been interested in sport as a spectator for as long as I could spectate, but I now benefit from listening to commentaries and having been able to see in my earlier years, I know what a red football shirt looks like, so I can visualise the commentaries. But I've also wanted to be a sports participant, so I've done cross-country running, marathon running, tandem cycling, cross-country skiing, hobby cat sailing. I've done all sorts of active sports, and most of them have been in open competition. I've done some sports for blind people. Many years I did the Metro Games that take place in North London each summer. But because of my desire not to be institutionalised, I've tried to take part in open sports. And luckily, I've found people who've been willing to help me either on the front end of a tandem or on the opposite end of a 6-inch piece of rope to me in the case of my running events. So I love sport. Plays a very important part in my life. But these days, my favourite sport is horse racing.
something that really chimed with me, and I know you say that it's the reason that you wrote the book, it's striking that balance between independence and asking for help. And you clearly feel that's central to the way that you participate in sport and central to your reason for the book being written.
Absolutely. I mean, there are those who think that somebody who has a book like this, they're engaging in vanity publishing. But I wanted to provide encouragement to those parents who have a child with a disability, to say to those parents that just because your child can't do everything, it doesn't mean that they can't achieve at anything. And likewise, I wanted to empathise with those like me who have those twin objectives of independence and achievement. And I think in my early stages, independence was my overriding goal. But I then realised that if I blindly pursued independence, I would have to cut back on the achievements at work, the achievements in sport. And I think I can bring it to life best really in the context of a canteen. I've always worked in places with canteens, and originally I would go into the canteen at 11:30 when it was empty and there was nobody in the way, and ladies would sell me my dinner and go and sit down. And then later on the ladies would say, tell us what you want, give us your money, go and sit down and we'll bring your dinner across to you. And then they said, no, we'll show you to your seat and then we'll bring your dinner across. And I then started going into the canteen when it was busy. And so I had lots of people that I could get to know, and I proved my independence. And my social achievement came from putting that independence on the back burner, accepting help, and hopefully improving my social skills a bit.
I couldn't agree more. I think some of the most fascinating conversations I have are with random strangers who I bump into who just ask whether I need to cross the road, whether they can help me get to wherever I'm going. A lot of it is in the way they phrase their offers of help.
But that's what's really improved my life, no end, Red. In one of the chapters, I've said, have I any regrets? And I guess the main regret that I have is not learning to use a white cane a little earlier. Again, independence ruled okay, but it wasn't okay because people thought I was standoffish at best, obnoxious at worst. But once I got my white stick, I've never had so many friends. Every day, walking from the station to the work, I meet at least two or three people and we have 5-minute chats, and I'm almost like their priest or their social worker in how frank and open they are with me, and I really know these people after 5 minutes, and then they cross the road and somebody else said, oh, she's not helping anymore, can I help you? And it really gives me an uplift meeting these people. One lady got it half wrong and half right when she said, I think you can see perfectly, but I reckon you've got an elbow fetish. I said, you're wrong on the first one, but you're right on the second one. I do like hanging on to an elbow.
It's strange. I feel very much the same as you. And yet I was in a panel discussion recently where there was very much a split down the middle. Men on one side saying, yeah, more than happy to be helped. Women on the other side saying, actually, we feel vulnerable enough without accepting offers of help from strangers. And I wonder if you have any views on that.
I'd never thought of it from a male female perspective, but there's always a danger that somebody who offers help may want to pick your pocket, but I've never come across that and never worried about it. I try to worry about things that I can do something about and not about things that I can't influence one way or the other. So I guess I do wing it a bit, and I probably go out at night in places where I ought not to go out at night, but I've survived.
Well, I mean, that can-do spirit and the refusal to buckle under what we both know is a rather cruel disease certainly comes through very strongly from the book. And as I say, I came away feeling rather uplifted and knowing a lot more about pensions, which, since we all have pensions, is quite a good thing to do.
Mission accomplished on my part then, Ray. That's good.
Indeed. So, Look Where You're Going, The Life of Alan Pickering, is the book that I've read this month that has educated me and opened my eyes. What about you, Alan? Have you read a good book this month?
Yes, I've been rereading some Dick Francis books. I mentioned that horse racing is one of my passions. Crime thrillers are my favourite form of reading, and Dick Francis brings horse racing and crime together. And what I really like about the Dick Francis books is that some of them are read by a wonderful man who is no longer with us, called Ian Wallace. And it was almost as if Ian Wallace was reading the book to me in my front room, because when he come to the end of it, he'd say, "Dear listener, I got that wrong. I got the wrong murderer." And it's just chatting to you. It probably is unprofessional. He might have got struck out of the brownies for doing it, but it was a really human, interactive way of reading a book to me. So the most recent ones are rereading some Dick Francis novels.
You're a member of the RNIB library, presumably, and access your books as talking books?
Yes, I have talking books from the RNIB, and I'm an avid reader. I must read a couple of books a week because I travel around a lot, so I read on the train. At home, I've got a big talking book machine. On the trains, I use a smaller CD player.
Well, there's plenty there to keep us occupied for many years to come. Alan Pickering, thank you so much for visiting the RNIB Connect Radio studio and for being a guest on Read On.
Thank you for having me. It's an honour.
Look Where You're Going, the biography of Alan Pickering, CBE, written by Paddy Briggs, is out now in hardback and ebook, with plans for an audiobook version soon. Do you have a favourite author who you'd like us to feature on the show? Or maybe you found a hidden gem in the RNIB library? Why not drop us a line via the usual email address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not head to our Audio Boom page? All our past shows are there, complete with book news, reviews, and exclusive author interviews. You'll find a link on the front page of our website, rnibconnectradio.org.uk. Or you can find producer Robert on Twitter at talking_books. Farewell until next week, and remember to read on.